everyone. Thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. The Democratic National Convention is a week away. How Democrats are preparing.
Though it will be the city's 27th time hosting a national political convention, it's tough to know what to expect from the event.
Plus, a look back at Chicago's history of hosting political conventions. And local indigenous leaders react to a report detailing tragedies at federal boarding schools. And now to some of today's top stories. Chicago's top cop says his department is ready for next week's Democratic National Convention. At an appearance at the City Club, Police Superintendent Larry Snelling says he didn't want to speculate on how many protesters the city will see, but says his team is prepared.
When people are here protesting, it doesn't matter what they're saying. As long as they're not engaging in acts of violence, they can have their voices heard, and we're going to protect their rights to do that. What we're looking specifically for are violent actors, those who are committing acts of vandalism, violent attacks against the police, against each other, against our citizens. That's the type of thing that we're not going to tolerate. The minute that starts, we have to put an end to it.
Meanwhile, parking restrictions are beginning today around the United Center and McCormick Place for the DNC. Crews began staging fencing for the event around both convention sites today. Officials say residents can expect intermittent traffic impacts in the areas. Full street closures will take place when the restricted security perimeter is complete at McCormick Place on Friday and at the United Center on Saturday. For the latest on traffic reroutes, be sure to check out the city's Office of Emergency Management and Communications app. A federal court judge rules that Illinois prison officials have until the end of September to transfer most of the people incarcerated at Stateville Correctional Center near Joliet. In the preliminary injunction filed late Friday, Judge Andrea Wood found deteriorating masonry walls, ceilings, and steel beams at the prison do cause a probable risk of irreparable harm. In a statement, the Illinois Department of Corrections says the agency didn't oppose the injunction, and the timeline ordered by the court is in line with the IDOC's existing timeline as part of a planned closure and rebuild of the prison. The union representing most IDOC employees says it's examining all options to prevent that disruption. For more on how this issue came before a federal judge recently, please visit our website. And one more note today, WTTW News launches a brand new email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan. It's a newsletter created with input from you. We'll bring you the news you need every day along with the backstory, helping you understand how we got to where we are and where we're going. We'll also help you explore your community, from connecting you with information to engage with our city to helping you navigate Chicago and its diverse communities. You can go to WTTW.com/newsletter to subscribe. Up next, local members of Congress on what we can expect in next week's DNC right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
National Convention is officially 1 week away. Presidential candidate Kamala Harris had a whirlwind of a week last week when she formally secured the Democratic nomination and announced Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate. As anticipation builds, Chicagoans wait to see what plans Democrats have for the event. Here to talk more about what we can expect are Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, a Democrat whose district includes some of the north side of Chicago, along with the Lake and Evanston. And on Zoom is Congressman Mike Quigley, a Democrat whose district includes Chicago's north side and some western suburbs. Thanks to the both of you for joining us. So first, I want to ask you how you're feeling about the DNC and if you think the Democratic Party is in a good place right now going into it. Congresswoman Schakowsky, I'll start with you, please.
There has been a burst of energy. All the people who are volunteering to work, to go to Wisconsin and Michigan and knock on doors, to make sure that we get out the vote. people are ready to fight and to work and to win. So it's just been amazing. And Kamala Harris has been flawless. She has just been perfect from day one as the next president of the United States. So I'm very optimistic. And I love Tim Walz. I served with him in the House.
And Congresswoman, you've been in politics for a while. Which convention would you say this is for you? How many have you been to?
Oh, I don't know, 20, 30, 40.
Enough to lose count.
A lot of conventions.
Will this one be, how different might this one be for you?
Well, I think that the stakes are so high right now, perhaps higher than I've ever seen before. The idea of Donald Trump versus Kamala Harris is fascism versus freedom. I mean, it's just that strong. And so I think that people understand the seriousness of this race, but also the joy of it. Finally, people are, you know, smiling and feeling happy.
Congressman Quigley, same question to you. How are you feeling about the DNC? And do you think the Democratic Party is in a good place right now heading into that week?
Sure. Let me add, I'm excited about showcasing our city, the most exciting, beautiful city in the world, showcasing our democracy. And as Jan alluded to, right, a unified, fired up Democratic Party. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to have some headaches for local residents, and understandably, it's 50,000 people coming to a city, and you know, a lot of people coming who are going to be in motorcades. So I think we brace for that, but very excited. I'll say this: the vice president had three tasks when she took over: unite the party, fire up the base, and reverse the polls. She is three for three. I mean, you raised $200 million in the first week, and you have 58,000 new volunteers in the first day. You know, that's a roll.
And Congressman Quigley, of course, you were one of the, or among the first Democrats in Illinois to call for President Biden to step back as the potential candidate for the Democratic Party. So it sounds like you believe that, obviously, that was the right call to make early on when few were doing it. And like Vice President Harris has your faith.
Look, what happened there was the President of the United States put the country first, as he always has. You know, we were in a difficult situation, and as hard as the president was trying, there was absolutely no focus on what he was actually doing or, frankly, what Trump was doing. So what the new nominee brings, besides this additional extraordinary energy, is, you know, the people who didn't know her get to know her a heck of a lot better, and that's turning out to be good news. There's a lot more focus on candidate Trump and his darker sides, as we have seen in the last few days.
Representative Schakowsky, you were initially in favor of President Biden staying in the race and believed that if he were to bow out, quote, there will clearly be a distraction from the agenda that we have, which is how dangerous electing Trump would be, and we won't be able to have those conversations about reproductive rights and all the things that we care about and that are being taken away from us. How's your thinking shifted since that day?
Well, Joe Biden himself made a decision. And it was really the right decision that he made on his own. And I really say that he is going to go down in history as perhaps the best president that we've ever had, certainly one of the best. And I am so proud of Joe Biden. And maybe the hardest decision he made was to say, I'm not going to run for president. It's time for a change. But I want to give him credit for having done that. That was really an incredible act of patriotism for him to do that.
So so far, you know, obviously the convention's next week, haven't seen a whole lot of policy out of the Harris campaign yet and what her platform looks like. Instead, they're definitely appealing to the excitement and the energy that they are getting from voters. Do you think that's a good strategy? What do we need to hear from her?
I think she's beginning to talk about the things that she will really do and her history. I mean, she has a long history, not only of her work in the law, and she says she knows guys like Donald Trump.
She has said she knows his type.
Yeah,
many times.
She knows his type. But, you know, she's also laying out an agenda that's going to work for ordinary people, for everyday people, to create the jobs, to work for unions, to make sure we all have our rights. We are going to be able, especially if we get the trifecta, right? The House, the Senate, and the White House. You'll see reproductive rights are back. We'll be able to really focus on the environment. All of these things are things that she has experience with, and I think she is going to talk plenty about the kind of agenda and has been doing it at these enormously huge hearing at
the rallies and she's out stumping for the
thousands
vote.
And thousands.
And she has told reporters that we can expect an economic policy from her this week. Congressman Quigley, how do you think she should distinguish herself from President Biden as she builds her own platform?
Well, look, first of all, I think the main task you're seeing now, you'll see at the convention, is a contrast. We talked about the vice presidential candidates alone. You know, I think with Vance, you see extremist policies, you know, Project 2025, which he agreed to. He said he wouldn't have certified the last election. And here you have Walz, who's called the, you know, agreeable, friendly guy. But, you know, he also was the first governor to sign protections of choice in Minnesota. And he got, the prescription costs down to $35. On important medicine there. So I think you're going to see a contrast in the spirit and the mentality of this. You know, I think every vice president who runs for president has the ability to build on the agenda. In this case, a very successful one of President Biden, who brought us out of January 6th, who brought us out of COVID, and had an extraordinary term of office. I think she can build upon that and distinguish herself where she sees fit.
Just about out of time, Representative Schakowsky, some lawmakers, as well as James Wilburn, the father of Sonia Massey, have called for Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act in the wake of Massey's killing by a white police officer in Springfield. The chances that Congress will take this up after the recess?
I am hoping, and it's so shocking happening in our own state. We need to take action.
Okay. We'll keep an eye on that, obviously, and hope to hear from both of you. As the next few months go on, Representatives Mike Quigley, Jan Schakowsky, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And, of course, make Chicago Tonight your home for the DNC next week. Join us live at 5:30 and 10 each convention night. We'll have live coverage and analysis before and after PBS NewsHour. And we're back with more right after this. The Democratic National Convention in Chicago is, as we've said, officially a week away, and tens of thousands of people are expected to visit the city. But this, of course, isn't the first time Chicago has been host to a national political convention. Amanda Vinicky has the scoop on the city's long history with conventions in tonight's edition of WTTW News Explains.
Chicago is set to host the Democratic National Convention this summer. And though it will be the city's 27th time hosting a national political convention, it's tough to know what to expect from the event. Perhaps because Chicago conventions have been some of the most memorable, raucous, and consequential in American history. Take the first Chicago convention in 1860. Republicans chose a young Illinois lawyer named Abraham Lincoln to be their standard bearer, even though Lincoln didn't even attend the convention himself. Then there was 1912, where the scene at the Republican convention was so tense that police and barbed wire surrounded the venue. It was former President Teddy Roosevelt versus his successor, the incumbent William Howard Taft. And while Roosevelt won most of the primaries, party leaders picked Taft anyway. The next day, Roosevelt supporters formed the New Progressive Party, and 6 weeks later, hosted their own convention in the same building, naming Teddy their nominee. In 1932, during the depths of the Depression, Chicago hosted both the Republican and Democratic conventions. Republicans nominated Herbert Hoover for re-election, while the Democrats chose Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who introduced a landmark proposal for the very first time.
I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people.
The 1952 conventions were the first to be televised live, coast to coast. Both were held in Chicago again, with Democrats nominating Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson, even though he explicitly said he did not want the job. He went on to lose in a landslide to Republican nominee Dwight Eisenhower.
I like it.
Fast forward to the infamous 1968 Democratic Convention, which descended into violence when Chicago police and Illinois National Guardsmen clashed with thousands of anti-war protesters in Grant Park, with Mayor Daley defending law enforcement.
The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
The Democratic Party walked away having nominated Hubert Humphrey, and the party divisions highlighted in Chicago helped Richard Nixon beat Humphrey that fall. It was 28 years before Chicago got a return engagement, and perhaps the most outrageous thing that happened in 1996 was delegates dancing the Macarena ahead of President Bill Clinton accepting his renomination. So what's in store for 2024? We'll soon find out.
And you can find more of our Emmy Award-winning series, WTTW News Explains, on our website. We're back with more Chicago Tonight in just a moment, but first, a look at the weather. A new report from the U.S. Department of the Interior concluded its three-year investigation into the legacies of federal Indian boarding schools. The schools were created to assimilate Native Americans by removing children from their homes and families and stripping them of their cultures and languages. One of the most upsetting findings in that report, 973 children were found to have died while in custody at those schools. Joining us now with their takeaways are Bradford Casberg, a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, and Ronnie Preston, a member of San Carlos Apache Nation and the program facilitator and cultural ambassador at the American Indian Center. Thanks to you both for joining us here.
Thanks for having me.
Bradford, let's start with you, please. What was your reaction to this report?
I was very happy to see that a report was generated about this. This is something that is no secret in Indian country. It's impacted virtually every family, but to be blunt, I was surprised at the number confirmed dead at the schools. That's something I saw universally across my community and even online. Surprised at the low number, but if you read the report, you can see that even they admit the shortcomings of the report, saying that numbers are likely far greater, and it's difficult to handle. But I'm very happy these conversations have been happening,
which is certainly heartbreaking. You know, nearly 1,000, and it might be more.
Yes,
Ronnie Preston, what was your reaction to this report?
No, same feeling, the same way. I'm happy that they're actually doing something about this now. For most of the different people down here. Knew that what had happened in Canada would soon find its way down here in the U.S., right, where so many things were happening to the children up at these boarding schools, and now we know for a fact that they have took place here in the United States as well, and they're finding these burial grounds. And just, I'm glad to see that they're doing something about this now.
Right. Yeah, of course, what you're referring to in Canada is the discovery of several mass graves of Native children who were found buried on those grounds. Despite the many attempts that we know of to kill Indigenous cultures, individuals like yourself, you've persevered, you continue to exercise your cultural practices, Bradford. How are you able to preserve the culture through your everyday life?
So everyday life is... culture is the big things, and it's the little things. It's not just holidays and seasons. It's the way you greet your relatives. It's the idea of who and what your relatives are. So there's a lot of small ways I can do that. Going outside and just being thankful for our land and our waters. But on a bigger picture, I've discovered over the past few years, because my community is pretty widespread, playing Dungeons and Dragons with a focus on Miami culture as sort of the basis of it has been a great way to just spend time together as people and actively share our culture and language when normally we're hundreds or thousands of miles away from each other.
Ronnie, you're an intertribal educator, so you spend a lot of time with the youth. How do you talk about these sort of difficult histories with young people, with children?
More or less, I use a hoop when I tell my stories. And I kind of use this hoop to show that our culture is like this hoop. And most people don't realize that we were a race of people targeted for genocide. They took our children from us and cut their hair off and, you know, abuse for speaking your language. And as our culture is still here today, you see that they didn't succeed. And the circles that reminds us of that, there is no beginning and our culture will never have an end. As long as we encourage our youth to speak their language, learn their songs, make regalia with us, they're keeping that spirit alive. And for the next seven generations that are going to be here. And a lot of this, what I do at the center is a lot of community engagement to everybody, not just Native people, but all community, to let them know the stories about our culture and who we are.
Tell us about, you know, you talk about the importance of Indigenous education, of course, and it, particularly with children learning where they come from. But can you also tell us about the significance of oral storytelling?
That's a good one for me because, you know, today's technology, kids just, you tell them something, out comes the phone, and you know, and they'll Google it. And but for me to sit with you and show you and speak with you, this oral tradition is the most powerful. And that's what we do with our community and our youth. We just finished up our summer camp where we had 22 people that showed up, and each one of them got to learn about a hand drum and then actually make one, and they bring a hand drum home, they get to play it, and you know that's the power of this oral teaching. And
what's a story that you like to teach your students?
Be who you are, learn your language, know your history. When we burn our sage, our cedar, we fan ourselves off with our eagle feathers, they know these stories, they don't feel it. And when I see these young people in the community practicing that, it makes my heart feel good.
Bradford, you know, trust in the federal government, a significant issue for many Native communities. And so we've got, you know, efforts like this one from Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, who, of course, the Interior Department is the one that released this report. You know, how do you think this report and its recommendations will sort of bridge a gap of distrust that Native communities have with the federal government?
Yeah, it's not lost on me that Secretary Haaland is an Indigenous woman. She's the head of the department, and I'm grateful that with her leadership, this was able to come out. And it's going to take time. It's going to take conversations, very difficult conversations, but one that in the report they state that they're going to go across the country, meeting with tribes, and. As well as out in Hawaii. So trust is something that you have to see action to really hold on to. So it's being willing to have those conversations, take accountability, and move that forward.
Ronnie Preston, same question to you.
I totally agree with that. There's a lot of reconciliation that's going to have to take place, and to gain somebody's trust back on such a sensitive subject, but I'm very grateful that Deb Haaland is moving forward to doing these things so that, just like with our campaign, Orange T-Shirt Day, every child matters. And it's a wonderful feeling knowing that this is taking place and there will be shown somebody needs to have that accountability for what took place.
It's a good place to leave it. Thanks to you both for joining us, Bradford Kassberg and Ronnie Preston. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this Monday night. As we mentioned earlier, today, WTTW News launched a brand new email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan. It's a new newsletter created with input from you. We'll bring you the news you need every day, along with the backstory, helping you understand how we got to where we are and where we're going. We'll also help you explore our community, from connecting you with information to engage with your city to helping you navigate Chicago and its diverse communities. You can go to WTTW.com/newsletter to subscribe. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Our Spotlight Politics team shares what it knows about the DNC, including safety and security plans. Plus, Cook County court officials are clearing judges' schedules ahead of possible mass arrests at the DNC. Chief Judge Tim Evans joins us on how it will work. And we leave you tonight with some new additions at the Brookfield Zoo, 3 baby flamingo chicks. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm dedicated to preserving the dignity and rights of all individuals.